From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
The president's dalliance with Democrats continues, and it's annoying Republicans in Washington, which may be why he's doing it. So far, FEMA seems to have worked fairly well in natural disasters under Trump. We'll discuss what's going right, and we'll discuss the new push for single-payer health care, the unmasking story that won't die, and new details on Trump's humiliation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Max Barak of The Washington Post joins us to discuss the crisis in Burma, ethnic cleansing of a Muslim minority group. Is there anything the U.S. can do about it? Plus, is the internet destroying your individuality? Frank Foer says it is. That's all up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Ross Douthat, opinion columnist for The New York Times. And our special guest is Susan Hennessy. She's a national security fellow at the Brookings Institution and the managing editor of the Lawfare blog. So, immigration politics continued to be odd this week. Dinner at the White House with Chuck and Nancy led to an announcement of something resembling a deal. The Democratic leaders said they would do a legislative version of DACA and border security, but that it would not include the wall. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders denied those terms, but then Trump substantively confirmed them later, saying a wall would come later and a fix for the protectees under DACA would come first. And he also tweeted that, hey, the wall already exists and we're already fixing it up, so that's already in process. But Republican leaders on Capitol Hill were cautious, asserting their prerogative to determine the design of an immigration deal. So I'll start where I did last week. Where are we now?
You got me. I mean, it's a week of whipsawing political news. The Chuck Nancy Amnesty Don caravan seems to be moving forward. No, I think seriously, you got people like Ann Coulter denouncing Donald Trump. You have people in the Congress unsure of where Trump is heading. You have on the progressive side, some willing to make the deal. Because enhanced border security has been part of an immigration policy. But then you do have people, as we were talking about, Josh, people on the progressive left who want a clean DREAM Act and don't want it tied to Trump's toxic agenda, whether it's wasteful border funding or deportation machine. So I do think there's a political question of how much Trump's base is really going to defect if he pursues it, because immigration policy, as the show has talked a lot about, has been at the forefront of Trump's promises, his agenda, and you got people inside the administration and out. It's
Ross, what do you think about that? I've been seeing warnings this week from people like Ann Coulter. I was on MSNBC with Joe Walsh, who is this far-right ex-Republican congressman, saying that Trump's base will abandon him if he does a deal with the Dreamers. And I sort of detect a twinge of fear in these people's voices, that they worry that that's not true and that Trump's base never cared about this issue in quite the same way that they did, and they will follow him if he makes this deal.
Yeah, I don't think we know the answer. It's a really interesting test in a way of how much of Trumpism is the sort of particular ideology that he came up with and campaigned on in the primaries and the general election, and how much of it is really a sort of cult of personality, where if Trump says, you know, that we're doing this now, enough of his supporters will say, well, that's good enough for me. What's interesting about the DREAM Act is that it is obviously, and, you know, this is something that everyone in Washington has been aware of for a long time, it's the place where public support for immigration restriction is by far the weakest. I mean, you know, if you poll people, if you poll Trump supporters on whether the Dreamers should be allowed to stay in the U.S., I think a plurality or a majority of even Trump supporters say yes. So it's not, you know, it's not the equivalent of Trump saying we're going to revive the Gang of Eight bill, we're going to do a general amnesty, we're going to do even, you know, the equivalent of what Obama tried to do with, you know, with a much larger amnesty that was sort of swatted down by the courts. It's a much smaller and narrower thing. So I don't think it's putting Trump's full, you know, immigration restrictionist credibility on the line for him to do a deal on this. It's putting his credibility on the line with the segment of voters that care so much about this issue that they don't want to see any compromise whatsoever.
Susan, so Ross sort of describes there, I think, a pretty good case for why a deal should be doable here. Do you think it's going to get done?
I think it's hard to predict just because, you know, Trump is so sort of mercurial in general. I do think because of that broad public support, we probably are going to see a deal. You know, one of the interesting things is one of the conservative objections to DACA has been sort of this notion that's not premised on the policy objections, but instead on the idea that this is an unconstitutional exercise of presidential authority. This is for Congress to decide, not the president. Trump has actually sort of picked that up, right? That's what he's been tweeting, Congress, it's time to do your job, sort of distancing himself from some of the realities of embracing the policy of ending it. The problem for the Trump administration is that this is the exact opposite of the position that he's arguing in the travel ban cases, where he is asserting that the president has broad, almost unreviewable authority with regards to immigration and borders. So I think one of the interesting things as sort of Trump sort of walks down the path of potentially doing this deal is whether or not he's going to have to reconcile those two sort of fundamentally contrary positions.
I don't know.
You also have Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon this past week declared war on the Republican establishment. And if he is going to put money into primaries, Robert Mercer and Bannon met, you could see more divisions, more contradictions emerge within the Republican Party. It's over this issue. Or it's unclear how this plays. I do think Ross is right to say it's too early to tell. You got Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham and Steve King and all, you know, got the establishment of this, quote, movement railing against Trump. But that doesn't mean the base. And in fact, with the base, the Dreamer, the DACA position has not been as firm as others.
Ross,
right. And I mean, everyone agrees that this is a distinctive case of people who, you know, came here as children and so on, and who literally don't have a home country to go back to in anything like the way that an adult immigrant has to go back to. I think the question hanging over the debate from the conservative perspective has always been, in a sense, this is our best bargaining chip. This is something where, because everybody wants to do a deal, we should be able to get something out of it in terms of immigration restriction. And what Trump has done here that is, from any kind of conservative point of view, foolish is a sort of preemptive surrender on that. I mean, I know we're he's talking about border spending and so on, but Democrats are always willing. I mean, Katrina may disagree at this moment, but in general, Democrats have always been willing to vote for a little more pork for sort of generic border security funding, as long as it doesn't go to a wall. I mean, they voted for fencing and so on in the past, but it's not at all the equivalent of, you know, the things that conservatives actually want, like E-Verify and, you know, a shift to higher skilled immigration, some version of what Tom Cotton has been pushing and so on. Trump just sort of preemptively ruled all that out in his sort of negotiating style.
Well, except that on Friday morning, Trump sent this cryptic tweet, as he often does, saying that chain migration cannot be part of any immigration legislation. Right. So it's not obvious precisely what he means by that. The RAISE Act, which was this Tom Cotton bill from conservatives in the Senate that would further restrict immigration, would basically make it much harder for people to bring in their relatives through sponsorship as immigration moved toward people who are selected based on skills. But I wonder if what he means there is that people who are currently DACA beneficiaries who would receive some sort of legal status under this deal, that they shouldn't be able to sponsor their own relatives to come in the future. And that would be more than just border security. That would be a tough pill for Democrats to swallow. And Katrina, I wonder.
Well, I mean, I think there will be real divisions within the Democratic caucus, the party. I mean, progressives feel there's been too much of a criminalization of immigration. There's been too much throwing of money at border security. You're going to see states with attorneys general playing a very different role. You already see, I think, the incoherence of Trump and even, you know, the Chuck and Nancy show leading immigration advocates and undocumented immigrants living in the shadows and confusion and anxiety. So where this heads is still unclear, because I think you will see opposition. But, you know, under Obama, let's be honest, right? Lots of deportations and lots, as Ross nodded to, money thrown at enforcement security. How much more? And why criminalize? And why not this Clean Dream Act that I talked about?
I want to talk about another story from this week that I think is sort of subtly related to this, which was from the New York Times, describing the incident back in May where the president sort of blew up at Attorney General Jeff Sessions, told him he should resign, told him he'd been disloyal. This was the day that Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, had appointed Bob Mueller to be the special counsel overseeing Russia. The president is furious that Jeff Sessions has not protected him from the Russia investigation. And Jeff Sessions apparently actually sent the president a resignation letter, was very emotional in this meeting, per the descriptions that the New York Times reported. But then the president didn't accept the resignation letter. He sent it back with a handwritten note. I assume we're going to get to see the handwritten note someday, which I'm excited to see what that contained. But I wonder, you know, it seems like the end of DACA was almost Jeff Sessions backing the president into a corner, saying he wouldn't defend the program in court. There were all these conservative state attorney generals suing over the program. So the president's hand sort of got forced. And then turning around and looking for a deal with Democrats, Susan, do you kind of see that the way I do, as maybe a strategy for getting back at Jeff Sessions for putting the president in a corner?
So I agree there is a linkage. I'm not sure I see quite sort of the same thread of connection. I think the connection is, you know, in reading this account of Jeff Sessions just being absolutely humiliated by the president, reportedly describing it as the most humiliating experience he's had in public life, that, you know, whenever you're sort of asking yourself, well, why does he stick around, you know, that it's because he puts such a high priority on this, I think, quote, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to shape immigration. Immigration reform. And so I think that I do think that the stories are related, but more in the sense that that's the reason why we see Sessions standing firm sort of in situations in which other people would have more forcefully resigned.
I think it's...
Ross and then Katrina.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think that description is plausible, but I think the more immediate impetus for what we're seeing is more likely to be Trump's exhaustion, frustration, and frankly, dislike for the Republican leadership in Congress. I think the DACA thing sort of happened to come along at a moment when he was generally exasperated with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. And it's not a coincidence that it followed on the heels of this, you know, this mini debt ceiling deal that got Trump sort of a wave of positive coverage on Morning Joe, which he still likes, and suddenly was like, well, why shouldn't I talk to Chuck Schumer about DACA too? Well, I don't even like... There was a story probably in the Times.
But Ross, remember...
Somewhere. Go ahead.
Ross, remember, I mean, Senator Schumer, not Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell, were at Trump's wedding. I mean, let's do some wedding, serious wedding politics. No, I think... Who wouldn't be sort of sick of, fed up with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan? But I do think there is a link here. I think Jeff Sessions a week or so ago got to get out there and roll out the anti-Dreamer program, right? He was giddy. And there was a sense of, you had a sense that maybe Sessions put up with the indignities that might cause most people to quit because he believed he could make a difference on immigration policy. And he seemed to be out of the doghouse when he gave that speech.
And here goes the president undermines it.
Yeah. So I also wanted to say there's one thing interests me that I think Sessions said he'd never been talked to like that. Note a theme, a little thread through some of the coverage. General Kelly, who's no wuss, said the same thing. He had never been dressed down by anyone in his career like Donald Trump. What is going on?
We're going to take a break. Up ahead, hurricane response and what can be done about the crisis in Burma. You're listening to Left, Right and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Ross Douthat of The New York Times. And our special guest is Susan Hennessy of the Lawfare blog. So over the last month, the U.S. has faced two very significant, very damaging hurricanes. And the efforts of this administration and the Federal Emergency Management Association have been, I think, fairly widely praised. Susan Hennessy, you graded the administration's response this week. How do you think our disaster response has been performing?
Yeah, so I have sort of a bifurcated grade here. And one is the president's personal grade. And I think that Trump performed not so well, right? He lacked the empathy and leadership and ability to be sort of apolitical that we've come to expect from both Republican and Democrats. On the other hand, his administration, and particularly FEMA, Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert, really performed very admirably, showed a lot of sound, sensible judgment. The Coast Guard, once again, heroic effort. What I think it is it's a good example of the value of having experienced individuals. There actually is a law that requires that the FEMA director have 5 years of experience in emergency management. So we're lucky that it was FEMA director, FEMA administrator Long, and not, for example, Eric Trump's wedding planner. And so I think what we are seeing is the value of experience sort of in action.
It seems to me that in these jobs where Trump doesn't have a big personal emotional investment as he does on some issues like on crime and immigration, there are two kinds of people that he seems to pick for these jobs. Sometimes, as you allude to, the event planner for the Trumps who got a fairly senior job at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But then some of these picks, like this guy Brock Long, who's running FEMA, Don Shulkin, who's the Veterans Affairs Secretary, he seems to have made fairly traditional, well-qualified picks and set back and let at least some of these people do their jobs. So it looks like that's part of why some of this stuff is working, right? Ross, what have you thought?
One issue, of course, too, is local leadership, right? And, it's mm-hmm. always an incredible challenge to figure out exactly how to respond to these deeply uncertain weather patterns. And you saw this in the debate around Houston about evacuation. And, people said, well, we did an evacuation last time and the evacuation was worse than the storm and more people died in that and so on. And there was a lot of argument about whether they should have done it this time. But overall, one big difference between these storms and Katrina is that you don't have the equivalent of the local failure that you had on the ground in Louisiana, too. And so you had, with Katrina, you had federal and local failure at the same time. And here you had combined good performance, state and federal. And I think that's an important part of it. And generally, this is sort of a data point in favor of the argument that the U.S. government can continue to function pretty well with total chaos in the White House, which is itself a sort of fascinating political science experiment we're running that people will be writing dissertations on in political science departments for years to come.
Just briefly, I continue to believe that it was not the end of George W. Bush's presidency was Hurricane Katrina and the way it was handled. I mean, heck of a job, Brownie, the failure of FEMA. I wish it was Iraq as a debacle, but I think it was the incompetence shown in handling Hurricane Katrina that opened the door to the end of the Bush administration in, political terms.
I think it was a third thing. His approval numbers fell all through 2005 with the Social Security privatization push.
But don't you think heck of a job? There's more attention to FEMA now by any administration because the understanding, if you fail on the ground, and understanding what you said, Ross, about local leadership, but if you fail with FEMA, you fail in those critical times. Well, incompetence doesn't have a politics.
I think FEMA cost him whatever remaining media support or sort of the media reputation he had compounding Iraq. I agree with Josh that the polling data suggests that the big thing was Social Security reform in terms of undercutting his sort of compassionate conservatism, populism stuff that he'd done pretty successfully in his first term.
Susan, that law you described requiring the FEMA director to have experience, that's a direct response to the Michael Brown Bush administration thing, right?
It's even colloquial known as Brownie's Law. there certainly are some constitutional limitations, right? So, I mentioned that Tom Bossert did a really good job. And you couldn't put those kinds of restrictions, statutory restrictions, on somebody who's a White House official like that. But for officials in the administration, it's certainly possible to use statutes. There are other examples. So the Department of Energy, the Undersecretary for Nuclear Security has to be an expert in nuclear security. And so this is, I think, for the first time, there really is an opportunity for Congress to consider, hey, what are those positions kind of related to public health, public safety, in which as a nonpartisan matter, we want to see some degree of competence and experience.
I want to touch on one more story from this week, which is this unmasking story about Susan Rice. You might remember this is the controversy about intercepts of conversations between U.S. persons and foreign persons. And then Obama intelligence officials had the identities of the U.S. persons in those conversations revealed, and they turned out to be associates of Donald Trump before he was president. And Trump and his allies have harped on this, saying it was inappropriate, political, alleging that it was illegal, and they've fixated in particular on Susan Rice, who was the national security advisor in the Obama White House. And so this week, apparently Rice told House investigators why she had Trump officials unmasked. CNN says that she was trying to figure out why the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates came to New York at the end of 2016 unannounced. Usually foreign officials like that will tell the State Department when they're coming to the country. This was before the UAE sought to set up a back channel between Russia and the Trump transition. Susan, is this a valid explanation of why you would have someone unmasked?
Yeah, so one of sort of the struggles in responding to this kind of strange line of attack that sort of originated with Devin Nunes and then the White House really picked up has been that these are such fact-specific determinations, right? To say whether or not unmasking was appropriate or not appropriate, you need to actually understand what the intelligence in question is. And so it was sort of this weird thing where the White House was lobbing accusations that it was hard to sort of refute other than to say, well, there's no indication here of any kind of wrongdoing. And sort of over time, that position has been reinforced. Richard Burr in the Senate said, you know, that he'd reviewed this stuff. He didn't see anything. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster had apparently also reviewed the unmasking in question. He'd come to the same conclusion, no wrongdoing. Now what we have is those fact-specific details, right? So why exactly was she looking for this type of information? This is precisely the kind of situation in which an initial intelligence report would go out with that masked identifier, right? It would say U.S. person number one, U.S. person number two, and it would be entirely reasonable for a national security official to say, hey, I need more information in order to understand the context, in order to really understand this intelligence, in order to do my job. So I really do think it's a vindication of Rice that there just wasn't wrongdoing here.
Politically, I think you need to look at this in the context of the Russia issue. I mean, I think Susan Rice, you got to look at the timeline. Crown Prince's trip to New York came shortly before the UAE brokered this meeting in January between a Trump associate and a Russian close to President Putin in the Seychelles Island to create this back channel of communication between Trump and Russia. There was a lot of attention being paid to that. Weirdly, as you dig deeper, it seems that part of that was the UAE hoping to encourage Russia to distance itself from Iran. I mean, this gets confused, right? I mean, so, you know, it's unclear, but to me, this must be viewed in the context of post-Hillary Clinton defeat, Obama White House staffers agitated about their failure to do more about the potential alleged unmasking of collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign.
I guess the question is it proper for an outgoing White House to be trying to keep tabs on the foreign conversations of an incoming administration, Susan?
Well, I don't think it's sort of right. The notion that they were on the way out the door and therefore, like, Barack Obama wasn't the president of the United States in the full sense of the term. No, you know, we have this concept of sort of one president at a time. We have the Logan Act, although, you know, that's not really something that's criminally enforced.
We couldn't get through this like conversation.
Exactly.
It's like the emoluments clause. We're all experts now.
Right, exactly. I acknowledging that it is never actually the Logan Act, what, you know, it does sort of enshrine this principle that, you know, there is one individual that is responsible for U.S. foreign policy. So one of the reasons why there were so many questions related to Mike Flynn's phone call with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, why was he having these conversations in the transition period? Were they aimed to undermine the Obama administration foreign policy? Because it's not appropriate, it's not okay to be doing that prior to your own inauguration. So I don't think there's anything untoward, or they're trying to you know, take a shot on their way out the door. They're fulfilling their national security function and their foreign policy function.
But there have been back channels through history.
Ross, go
right.
ahead.
I think everybody was behaving maybe mildly inappropriately, but within normal bounds on the evidence we have that, you know, whether or not it was inappropriate As Katrina says, these kind of back channels are quite normal in history. The question is, in this case, was there evidence of some, you know, of some darker crime related to, you know, emails, hacking and so on that leads to the whole collusion and so forth. But all of that, you know, nothing that Susan Rice did uncovered evidence of that. So, yeah, I guess as always with the Russia business, I feel like I said this last week, I'm awaiting more information to formulate a dispositive opinion on it. And right now, all of this just seems like sort of semi-inappropriate but normal bureaucratic maneuvering. And the other point, which I think Andy McCarthy at National Review has raised, and he's obviously no fan of the Obama White House, but he raised this a couple of times. He said, look, if there was something really bad here that the Obama White House did, the Trump White House has the power, and Ms. Susan can correct me if this is wrong, to declassify all kinds of things that would reveal this kind of wrongdoing. If the Obama White House had done all kinds of, you know, terribly inappropriate, borderline criminal things to undermine the Trump team during the transition, the Trump team would have lots of ways to, you know, bring that into the public eye besides sending Devin Nunes out to say some cryptic things about unmasking. And the fact that they haven't revealed anything, and in fact, you know, as that McMaster and others have said that there's probably not much here, suggests that there isn't that much there.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow. I've been talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, Ross Douthat of The New York Times, and Susan Hennessy of the Lawfare blog. Thank you, Susan, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to introduce a new guest now for a segment we've been calling It's Been Busy. The idea is that we've all been so busy talking about the latest shocking developments in the news that we often don't get to focus on some of the really important things that have been happening. So this week, the United Nations called atrocities being committed in majority Buddhist Myanmar against the Muslim Rohingya people, quote, a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. To discuss the crisis, we're now joined by Washington Post reporter Max Barak. Welcome, Max.
Thanks for having me.
So, Max, can you just describe for us, I mean, the Rohingya have been persecuted for some time, but what is the latest crisis that has happened here?
Well, that's right. It's been decades. And since the late 1970s, there have been waves of violence between the Buddhist majority and the Rohingya Muslim minority. But this seems to be those decades of persecution coming to a head. And we are seeing a much more massive scale of Rohingya fleeing to neighboring Bangladesh to the extent that nearly half of those that had remained after those previous waves have now left, numbering about 400,000, in addition to the 400,000 that were already living in Bangladesh.
And so what has the Myanmar is run by Aung San Suu Kyi, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. The U.S. has been sort of proud of its normalization of relations there. Is there anything we can do about this? Is this showing that, you know, the government that we thought was a good government there is not?
Right. So in the democratic transition that took place in 2011, 2012, she became Myanmar's de facto leader. But in the agreement that was reached then, the Myanmar military retained a lot of autonomy and even seats in the parliament that are reserved for them. And so what we're seeing here is the military joining hands with some segments of the Buddhist population in southwestern Myanmar and teaming up to achieve a goal that they've long held, which is the expulsion of the Rohingya from that part of the country, because they see them essentially as illegal immigrants from neighboring Bangladesh, to the extent that they also refer to them officially, as does Aung San Suu Kyi, as Bengalis and not Rohingya. As to what the U.S. can do, well, before the democratic transition, the U.S. had sanctions on Myanmar, which was then ruled by the military entirely, the military junta. Those sanctions could be reinstated. Of course, the U.S. has a role to play in the aid and relief effort that's going on. But most people here are waiting for Tuesday, when Aung San Suu Kyi will address her nation, to see what her stance is and then decide from there whether there's really any chance of this whole catastrophe turning itself around.
You know, I wanted to ask you about Aung San Suu Kyi. I mean, she received the Nobel Peace Prize, as we discussed. I mean, she was praised for her moral leadership and compassion. Now we're seeing the condemnation of her lack of moral leadership, in fact, calls for her to return the Peace Prize. Could you briefly tell us, I mean, her history with this crisis, and is it the military's grip on power that has undermined her, or had she compromised deeply on this issue, which has been going on for years, as you know? I mean, since the late 1970s, I think nearly 1 million Rohingya have fled Myanmar due to widespread persecution.
Right. Well, in some ways, her hands are tied. But on the other hand, we do expect a certain degree of moral leadership and for her to use her voice to stand up for her self-proclaimed values of pacifism and human rights and democracy that she fought for decades and was recognized with the Nobel Peace Prize for. And she has not done that. In her speech on Tuesday, she may do that. But I think a lot of the international ire has been misdirected at her because the real perpetrators of the ethnic cleansing that's ongoing are people in the Myanmar military. And so perhaps more attention should be paid to the commander-in-chief of the Myanmar military and also nations around the world who fund and train and arm the Myanmar military, primary among them being the United Kingdom.
Ross, did you have a question?
I wondered if you could just talk a little bit more about the sort of specifically religious dynamics here, because of course, in the sort of, you know, conventional and often largely ignorant Western narrative of world religions, the idea of sort of militant Buddhists persecuting Muslims is one of the strangest ideas that people have. It seems like a very strange idea to Western audience accustomed to thinking about Buddhism as the most peaceful of world religions. So could you talk a little bit about sort of those religious distinctives and the sort of particular religio-political things going on within Burmese or Myanmar and Buddhism?
Well, I think it's helpful to remember that in any religious group or really any subgroup at all, there can be more militant wings and more peaceful wings, and they'll always claim that they're representing the true version of their religion. The Myanmar government and military are capitalizing on the fact that there is a fledgling Islamist militancy among the Rohingya that reports say is funded by individuals in the Persian Gulf and in Pakistan. And they're using that as a pretense to kind of initiate this large-scale displacement of an ethnic majority that they don't want to have there. But it is true that that there is a long-standing Buddhist militancy in Myanmar that has targeted not just Rohingya, but other ethnic minorities, often ones who've converted to Christianity in different parts of the country.
We've been talking with Max Barak. He's a Washington Post reporter covering Myanmar on his way in just a couple of days to the border with Myanmar and Bangladesh, if I understand correctly.
That's correct.
Thank you very much for joining us, Max.
My pleasure.
We will be back to talk about the push for single payer. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Ross Douthat of The New York Times. And joining us now is Franklin Foer. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the new book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. This week, Bernie Sanders introduced legislation for a single-payer healthcare system. It's being billed as Medicare for All, but it would actually be significantly more generous than existing Medicare, covering everyone's healthcare with no copayments, no deductibles, and no premiums. But perhaps the bigger news is that 16 Senate Democrats have signed on as co-sponsors for the bill. Katrina, what do you make of single-payer gaining such purchase among more mainstream Democratic officials?
Well, I think this is a testing time for Democrats. First of all, I go back to Bernie Sanders' campaign. That campaign drove Medicare for All into the center of debate. It was a marginalized issue. It shouldn't have been. It's interesting that quite a few of those 16 co-sponsors are contenders for 2020 presidential. You know, I think critics are warning the Democratic Party this is a move in the wrong direction. Wrong. Medicare for all could be a winning political issue for the party. I mean, it doesn't need to turn out to be like Republicans' failed attempts at repeal and replace. I think Sanders' plan offers the Democrats a clear, compelling idea to fight for at a time that, you know, to some, the party seems aimless other than its hatred of Trump. I think people haven't looked under the radar. There's some other core ideas that are there. But it's time for the, you know, we have an exclusive interview with Bernie Sanders at thenation.com this past week. And he explains, you know, that there's an incrementalism, that there's a policy that has built out a movement around this. And it is over a 3-4 year period. You can argue about the funding, but this is aspirational in the best sense of the Democratic Party.
Frank, as Katrina notes there about the funding, I see two main political stumbling blocks for trying to turn this into a law. One is the need to come up with something like $32 trillion additional dollars for the federal government to spend over a decade. That's a massive increase relative to the $53 trillion the federal government would already spend on everything else. And then also that, you know, it involves taking away health plans that a lot of people like, putting everyone on this plan, whether they want it or not. And some people will say, you know, I like my current health care. I don't want these big changes again.
Right. It's a pretty ill-sketched plan as it exists now, which is, I think, is part of the point. That's part of the reason why so many people are able to gravitate towards it. And there are real political problems with shifting 155 million Americans to a single-payer system. But that's not really the point of this. I mean, I think the reason that Democrats are gravitating in this direction are twofold. The first is, I think we have to look at what constitutes the Democratic Party as it exists now, which is that there is no Barack Obama, there is no Clinton. Bernie Sanders is the closest thing that there is to a leader of the Democratic Party. And all of the action and all the political action right now is on the left. So I think that this reflects that. And then the second is that I think that the Democratic Party was in need of a vision replacement. I remember when Obamacare was passed, that there were lots of people on the center left who said that, well, the social safety net had now been fully constructed, that we were on the track to universal health care. And if you look at the Hillary Clinton campaign, I think she struggled to articulate what the next frontier would be for the safety net and for social welfare within the Democratic Party. And so I think that even if this goal is not one that I think is necessarily achievable in the form that Sanders articulated it, I think Democrats are kind of craving that kind of sense of direction.
Ross, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is a bad idea. On the merits. And it's a bad idea because it would be massively unpopular, that most Americans are very content with employer-provided insurance. And employer-provided insurance is, in fact, in many cases, better than what single-payer systems in most other countries provide. What Sanders is proposing is a single-payer system more generous than most of the ones in welfare states around the world. And it would require, massive tax increases that would be eventually offset in part by wage increases, because wages wouldn't be coming out of your pocket to pay for employer-provided health care. Things would shake out eventually to some extent. But, you know, Democrats lost Congress and sort of crippled Obama's presidency legislatively in order to pass a far more incremental, far less disruptive health care reform. The idea that you would... The idea that
I don't
you
know
would
which planet
this,
you're living on, Ross. That this is massively
living on the
unpopular. I mean, greater government role in healthcare is not massively unpopular.
Single payer polls well if you ask people, should there be single payer? I mean, it doesn't poll great.
I mean, Medicare for
decently.
All polls even better. Yeah.
Well, Medicare for all is not what Bernie Sanders is proposing. Now, if you walk this system back, as a reasonable Democratic candidate could do, to some kind of public option Medicare buy-in proposal, then it could be popular. And maybe that's where this is going. I'm just saying this proposal is something for Democrats to run on in 2020 is insane. And especially since the Democrats' problem, this is something that Josh, I think, has written very eloquently about, so I'm sure he'll agree with me, is that they didn't have an answer to Trump's promise to have better jobs and higher wages. And this proposal doesn't address either of those. It addresses a healthcare system that only 15 to 20% of Americans are dissatisfied with. Take this money and promise a wage subsidy, promise a jobs program, promise a guaranteed basic income, promise something other than the total disruption of the American healthcare system, and you'll be in better shape.
I think conservatives should be for this and progressives as well. If you care about cost control, I think you find that in a Medicare for All system, and also access. You can't get to better access with the system we have. And, you know, there is work to be done on how to fund this. But let's look at what we have. Our system we have is Byzantine, unfair, and expensive. I'm not going to cite all the reports showing how much Americans pay for healthcare, how little they get. But I think you're absolutely wrong politically. I think for too long, Democrats have been scared of their own principles, working within the parameters of political debate set up by Ronald Reagan. Sanders and this plan gives them a chance to move in a different direction with a concrete health plan that would afford and expand affordable coverage and access to millions of Americans.
I think you get cost control in other government-run systems because you have a powerful gatekeeping role played by the government payers. Like in the United Kingdom, which has some of the cheapest healthcare in the developed world, they achieve very good value for money. But part of the way they do that is by having the government decide what's not cost-effective and not paying for it. And if you're going to do that, you can get very good cost control. But this program comes with these big promises about how they're going to pay for everything with no co-payments and no deductibles, which encourages people to go out and consume more healthcare because they pay no more at the margin. And then also the political compromises you'd have to make to get this done, the vociferous objection that you would have, not just from the insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies that Democrats like to talk about taking on, but from doctors who are popular and who would be very upset about any effort to control their payment rates. To get this done, you would end up taking the U.S.'s extremely high cost structure and putting the whole cost of it on the government books.
We can sit here and argue about all the obstacles. I say, let's get it on. Politics is the art of the possible. Let's try and make something possible that would benefit millions of people.
I want to turn to Frank's book before we go, because authors always want to talk about their books.
Thank you.
Frank, so your thesis in this book is basically that big tech companies are destroying our individuality. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we've always had tools and technology, and those have been the things that have defined us as human beings. But over the course of the last 10 years, we've had the advent of all these incredible new technologies, which have been great. We've had the advent of the iPhone and the Kindle and the invention of social media. But the magical qualities of these inventions have blinded us or prevented us from talking about some of the darker implications of them. And one of the darker implications of them is that these technologies are intellectual technologies, that these companies help control the way in which we interact with reality, whether it's the way that we interact with news and information, or the ways in which they hope to have us occupy virtual realities, or the ways in which we've now become addicted to a lot of these technologies because they have so much data about us. They have this incredibly intimate portrait of our psyche, which they use to keep us clicking as much as possible. And so I have my core concern in this book is really about the future of the human as a being capable of thinking, contemplation, independent thinking, and my concern about the future of our democracy, because it's really unhealthy to have this concentration of power in the handful of four or five big monopolist firms, which are able to exert control over markets, over information, over culture, and therefore over democracy.
So I feel like there's been this sort of broader fashion. Your book is in a conversation that's happening right now where you have a lot of people in the media who are expressing these sorts of concerns about the power of big tech companies. And it's part of a broader conversation about monopoly and concentrated corporate power. But I feel like there's been a real disconnect between certain elite commentators and the public here. That, like, if you ask ordinary people about industries and companies that are disserving them because they're able to exert too much power, they'll talk to you about insurance companies, they'll talk to you about telecom companies, they'll talk to you about banks. And these big tech companies, companies like Google, Facebook, are offering products that consumers generally see as working pretty well, and products that are often either, you know, cheap and getting cheaper over time, or they're totally free to the consumer. Isn't this a sector that's actually working fairly well for the consumers that are using it, providing products that people are satisfied with? This doesn't feel to me like a mass concern in the way that you could have about other industries.
Yeah, I basically agree with that, that there is this disconnect between an elite conversation, which is happening pretty quickly. There was, I think, the reversal of conventional wisdom among elites, if it's happened at all, has happened actually fairly suddenly and largely after the election, when Facebook's role in the election, I think, caused elites to wake up to some of the problematic natures of that social network. And if we're going to talk about elites, I think that Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods started to bring about an anxiety about corporate gigantism among certain elites that hadn't existed before. And so consumers like these products, and hell, even I wrote a book denouncing these companies, and I use Gmail and Google and shop at Amazon and look at Facebook. I mean, there's no arguing with the benefits of these technologies per se, but I want us to have a conversation, and it's going to start, I think, at an elite level initially before it has any broader traction, about some of the issues of what happens when we become dependent on these companies and the values of these companies upon which we're so dependent. And maybe it's because elites in some ways were canaries in the coal mine, because journalism and book publishing happened to be places where elites live that happened to become enormously dependent on Facebook, Google, and Amazon for their financial health, that maybe elites have a very personal sense of the cost of some of these monopolistic companies.
Is there a remedy available here? I mean, you mentioned the Amazon Whole Foods acquisition, but Whole Foods is 2% of the U.S. supermarket industry. So any sort of normal antitrust analysis you might do, I think, would find that Amazon is not anywhere close to exerting big market power in the grocery business. If you're concerned about this, is there any actual policy available that would address these concerns?
Well, not as antitrust is currently constituted. So in the 1960s, antitrust took this big swerve, where antitrust had been concerned with corporate size as an issue and about some of the democratic implications of corporate size. But starting with Robert Bork's famous essay about antitrust in the 1960s, it became very, very narrowly obsessed with the issue of consumer welfare. And so the entire way we judged a corporation over the course of the last couple of decades has been about whether they set prices low and whether they bully their competitors. And so we haven't really looked at monopoly as a much broader sort of problem. But there's a lot of rethinking that's happening right now among people. There was an article, great article, this 28-year-old called Lena Khan published about the Amazon conundrum, which is that it's hard to apply antitrust against Amazon because it is so obsessed, maniacally and kind of wonderfully obsessed with low prices. But if we just left it at that, we wouldn't be addressing some of the other problems with Amazon. And part of this goes from an issue where so much of our policy is about treating people as consumers, which is we're all consumers, but we're also citizens, and we should care about things other than price. We should care about whether we have, whether our society has access to quality information, whether some of the gatekeepers are bullying when it comes to producers of information, whether we've created we've created corporations who are maybe in some ways too deeply enmeshed in our lives through their accumulation of data. And there's a need for new paradigms for thinking about these problems.
Well, the book is called World Without Mind: The Existential Threat of Big Tech by Franklin Foer. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Ross Douthat, it's your soapbox.
I'll start with something that I think dovetails very well with Frank's book and argument, which is a New York Times story about that's up today, I think, that it's about how the Amish are adopting the use of iPhones and other similar communication technologies in their workplaces. And I find this appalling because, frankly, when we finally reach a level of sort of moral awareness to realize that digital communication is destroying our very souls, we're going to need groups like the Amish there to help us rebuild civilization in the wreckage. And if even they are being corrupted by the lure of, Twitter, Facebook, and all the rest, then we're pretty much doomed.
What about the radio, Ross? We're part of the problem right here. Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your rant?
So last night was my mother's memorial celebration. My mother, Jean Stein, lived a life of great adventures with an unerring talent for gathering troublemakers, actors, writers, poets, politicians, whistleblowers. In her journal, Grand Street, at her apartment, she inspired me to become the editor, writer I am. Her book, Edie, inspired a new generation of oral historians. Her last and acclaimed book, West of Eden, chronicled five families, including her own, and revealed Los Angeles and Hollywood's potent influence on America's past, present, and future. Her 1956 Paris Review interview with William Faulkner is a classic, important for any aspiring writer to read. Faulkner told my mother, "The writer's only responsibility is to his art. He will be completely ruthless if he is a good one." She was an unconventional mother of gentleness and generosity who gave me so much love. I will miss her.
I'm so sorry for your loss, Katrina. Lovely remembrance. Franklin Foer, what do you want to rant about?
Well, that was beautiful, and may her memory be a blessing. I want to rant about a piece that appeared in ProPublica yesterday about how Facebook was allowing advertisers to target anti-Semites through Facebook by buying ad search terms like Jew hater on it. And there was another piece that was published this morning about how Google allowed advertisers to target with keywords like Jewish parasite and Black people ruin neighborhoods. And both of these examples highlight the way in which these gatekeepers, these powerful pipes through which information flow, take no real moral responsibility for what they do, and the ways in which everything has been commodified and in a way highlights the entire bankruptcy of these systems that they've created.
That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Katrina Vandenhoevel, Ross Douthat, Susan Hennessy, Franklin Foer, and Max Barrack. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.